the latest agriculture news from across the state and the nation, here's Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. Filling in for Danielle Leal, here's today's host, Taylor Hillman.
Good morning. Thanks for joining us for another episode of Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. There's lots to get to in today's show, including how the indoor heat standard changes may be coming pretty quickly. Also, May rains are hitting the state, and there's a little concern for some growers. Also, we talk to the Almond Board of California later on in the show about the newly released subjective forecast and how the markets are setting up for a big 2019 crop. If you haven't heard, there was a big fire in Sacramento this week at the Blue Diamond facility. Reports say that almost the entire Sacramento Fire Department was battling the blaze. We've been in contact with Blue Diamond, who's looking into the matter, trying to find out more information. Brian German will have a report on that in tomorrow's show. Also, the University of California made an official statement on the chlorpyrifos ban news. Director of the Statewide Integrated Pest Management Program, Jim Farrar, said in a release that there, of course, is concern over the action, but he wanted to reiterate that they've been working for several years to find alternatives to the pesticide. I will have a longer report on that tomorrow as well, but for now, let's get to today's news. It looks like the indoor heat standard update is being prepped to be pushed through the approval process quickly. As AgNet West reported earlier in the week, the language for the proposed new indoor heat standard was changed slightly at the end of April.
I want to say in total they've made about 12 to 15 changes. There's a couple of other sections where, again, they've gone on to further provide clarifying definitions. So again, under the definition of heat index, they've given us some even greater clarifying language where it speaks to now added into the standard is for the purposes of the standard, heat index refers to conditions in indoor work areas. Again, that sentence might seem trivial to the outside observer, but to those of us who are navigating what this means from a compliance perspective, that kind of clarifying language is important in terms of knowing when would enforcement seek to enforce the parameters of this new proposed regulation.
AgSafe President and CEO Amy Wolf said some of the details are critical changes, but the more pressing issue is that the process is behind schedule and it looks like it may be getting fast-tracked to catch back up.
So the state legislature back in 2017 passed a piece of legislation that directed Cal/OSHA to get this standard written, reviewed, have the financial impact review done by the Department of Finance, and have a bow on top of this whole thing to put before the Cal/OSHA Standards Board as of January 1st of this year. Right now, we are still in the phase of draft language that has yet to be submitted to the Department of Finance. And as you and I talked previously, when Cal/OSHA attended AgSafe's annual conference this year, the representative from Cal/OSHA shared with us that they expect the financial review process with the Department of Finance to take upwards of a year. So you figure right now, we're a year and 5 months, almost a year and a half behind schedule. So what this fine-tuning tells me is the Cal/OSHA enforcement staff who are responsible for drafting this language are working diligently to ensure that when that package goes to the standards board, they're not caught by surprise by either employer or worker stakeholders in wanting something else added to the language. And really, once it goes to the standards board, that process is smoother, faster sailing than we sometimes see when this process plays out, where they don't spend as much preparatory time really fine-tuning and getting into the devil of details when it comes to new regulatory language.
Now here's Brian German.
When developing groundwater sustainability plans, a multitude of different factors must be considered. Executive Director of the Eastern Thule GSA, Bryce McAteer, talked about the importance of water markets in GSPs.
You know, water markets are the most efficient way to manage and share a scarce resource, and a resource that likely is going to become a lot scarcer over time. But if you also have a comprehensive water market system or a comprehensive sharing system, you can increase the localized benefits of that market. And so if you can incorporate recharge projects and recharge credits, if you can have good monitoring, there's a lot of different systematic issues that have to be considered, and a lot of different components to make that market function. But in my opinion, markets are a valuable asset for any GSA. It's important for growers to know how much groundwater do they have so they can plan for the future on what do they want to grow, how might they want to change their cropping patterns or their business patterns, and it's important to provide that sort of security for the long run.
Last year, California exported about $313 billion worth of goods and services, contributing to multiple areas of the state's economy. At the recent meeting of the California State Board of Food and Agriculture, Senior Advisor for International Affairs and Trade in the Governor's Office of Business and Economic Development, Bud Colligan explained the impact that trade has on the state's job market.
The trade-supported jobs in California are rising. They were 11% of our California economy in 1992, and today they're over 20%. Trade supports well-paying California jobs in distribution, in professional services, in personal services. And a little-known fact also is that firms that are importing or exporting pay their workers more, about 30% more than firms that do not. And trade supports California ag, of course, over 200,000 jobs. 70% of those are in California ag rural communities.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Storm systems coming through California are expected to cause some problems, but there likely will be a silver lining for the strawberry industry. Strawberry plants are thriving right now, and Manzanita Berry Farms General Manager Dave Peck said his plants are cranking out fruit. Many attendees at the annual Strawberry Field Day hosted by Manzanita Berry Farms, UC Cooperative Extension, the California Strawberry Commission, and other sponsors were talking about the May rains that are hitting the state. Peck said with production the way it is right now, some loss may actually be a good thing overall for the industry.
Well, like most successful farming industries, you know, overproduction always ends up becoming a problem, and everybody wants everybody else to cut back on production because the supply has gotten to be, you know, very huge here. Again, this year we're starting to see inklings of that in the marketplace. So if we could, you know, cut about half of the production for a couple of weeks, you know, strengthen the market price, I think everybody would do better. But, you know, that's the centuries-old problem with supply and demand and agricultural products, isn't it?
This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. We'll have more of the day's agriculture news in just a moment. And remember, you can always get the latest agriculture news from around the state and the nation at our website, agnetwest.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back to AgNet West's Farm City News Day. More agriculture news for you now.
The Innovation Center for U.S. Dairy announced its 8th annual U.S. Dairy Sustainability Award winners at its recent ceremony in Illinois earlier this month. Of the 5 winners of this year's award, one of them was a California dairy producer. The program is designed to recognize dairy farms, businesses, and partnerships that implement methods for improving the well-being of people, animals, and the planet. Philip Verway Farms received one of the Dairy Sustainability Awards for switching to an electronic stationary mixer instead of using a mixing wagon powered by a diesel tractor for blending feed ingredients. The 9,000-cow operation was able to substantially reduce its overall emissions level, equivalent to taking nearly 8,000 cars off the road. Philip Verway applied for funding through the San Joaquin Valley Air Pollution Control District's Technology Advancement Program in order to help convert the food mixing system. The success with the program led to expansion, inspiring other farms in the area to also apply for funding. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Despite recent setbacks in U.S.-China trade negotiations, the top USDA trade official is still expressing optimism that there will eventually be a deal. Gary Crawford has the story.
Many of us not in the inner loop of the U.S.-China trade negotiations were a little startled at last week by what seemed to us as a sudden pothole on the road to a trade agreement with China. But the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Undersecretary for Trade, Ted McKinney, says what happened was...
not surprising.
Not surprising. McKinney telling a group of farm broadcasters at USDA headquarters that during the last couple of agricultural negotiating sessions with China...
we sensed this backsliding starting, and then we compared our notes with other teams. So there was distinctly a change of views by our friends in China.
And now we have tariffs being raised on Chinese goods, China putting out lists of U.S. food and ag products it is targeting with tariffs. McKinney says a U.S.-China trade deal now seems further away than before.
But I still am optimistic that we will get there.
In Washington, Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Well, in today's livestock news, last week the push to pass the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement, or USMCA, took National Cattlemen's Beef Association officers to Mexico for meetings during the Mexican Cattlemen's Convention, where they also met with their counterparts from Canada. NCBA President Jennifer Houston notes there is an urgent need to pass USMCA and is asking Congress to move swiftly on it.
We had a very, very robust discussion during the meeting. We are all in agreement that this treaty needs to be ratified by all three countries as soon as possible, so much so that we did agree on a statement asking all of our governments to get this done just as quickly as possible. our exports to Mexico are valuable for a number of reasons, not just the total value of the exports, but also we're able to sell products down there that have little value here in the U.S., tongue, tripe, heart, cuts that we really don't eat a lot of in the U.S., whereas down in Mexico, they have a tremendous value and add a lot to the value of the beef products that we send to Mexico. In fact, in Mexico, when I was eating at a restaurant, it was very interesting that there was a tongue entree and there was a ribeye entree, and they were exactly the same price. So those kinds of beef products have value in Mexico. So our exports to Mexico and Canada account for about $70 per fed animal. And that's a lot to a feeder cattle producer or fed cattle producer, either one, here in the U.S.
Houston said USMCA keeps the same access to both Canada and Mexico.
For 25 years, we basically had free and unfettered access to Mexico and Canada, and it's really added value to all of our products. And that's the great thing about the USMCA, is it basically keeps that same free and unfettered access that we've enjoyed for 25 years as we've developed these customers, both in Canada, but especially in Mexico, that enjoy U.S. beef and want that high-quality U.S. beef, and they continue to want that access. So that's why all three nations thought it was so imperative that we band together and say that all three of the cattlemen's associations of these nations want this treaty ratified just as quickly as possible. Mm-hmm. And I'm optimistic that maybe hopefully something will be done by the end of the year. You never know with Congress, but we're gonna carry that water and keep repeating that mantra that just as quickly as we can to all of our leadership, it's important that we get this thing done and across the finish line.
Again, that was NCBA President Jennifer Houston. And according to the National Milk Producers Federation, the U.S. Trade Representative's office should slap tariffs on dairy shipments from Europe in response to the $11 billion in damage EU Airbus subsidies caused the U.S. NMPF President and CEO Jim Mulhern said, "We have a unique opportunity to make a big dent in the dairy access gap we face in Europe. The U.S. is currently running a $1.6 billion dairy trade deficit with Europe." He said a complex web of EU tariffs and non-tariff obstacles are to blame. I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West.
This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. We'll have more of the day's agriculture news in just a moment. And remember, you can always get the latest agriculture news from around the state and the nation at our website, agnetwest.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. I'm Taylor Hillman.
We are seeing a little uncommon weather this week. USDA's Brad Rippey talked about some of the storms we're seeing earlier this week and that it will likely boost snowpack. Stephanie Ho has more.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says more stormy weather is coming.
To get to the bottom of it, we're really focused right now on the Pacific Ocean, and we've got a series of winter-like storms starting to line up across the Pacific. And really, looking at some of the imagery, some of the satellite information, it really looks a lot more like late winter or very early spring.
The first storm is due to bring rain to coastal areas.
But a much more impressive system will arrive in California, northern and central California, on Wednesday-Thursday time frame, and that truly will look like a winter system.
He says this storm will bring snow to the Sierra Nevada.
And by the time we get to the end of the week and into the weekend, the first two storms will join forces across the nation's midsection, and it does look like a fairly significant rainfall event will break out across the plains and the upper Midwest.
The storms will bring several inches more rain and colder temperatures. This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Rippey went on to look at next week as well in his projections.
This covers the time period from May 21st through the 27th. And it does look like the cold air that is starting to settle into the western U.S. will stick around for a long time. We are expecting below normal temperatures across the entire western half of the country, as well as along the Canadian border. Meanwhile, above normal temperatures expected from the eastern portions of the central and southern plains eastward to the Atlantic seaboard, from southern New England southward. At the same time, wet weather accompanying those cool conditions, so we're expecting above normal precipitation across the entire western and central United States, also along the Canadian border. Drier than normal conditions should be restricted mostly to the southeastern United States.
How sunflowers provide a helping hand in your garden. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. Many people grow sunflowers for the simple fact that they are stunning, massive flowers that brighten up the scene. However, sunflowers are beneficial in the garden for many reasons. They are easy growing and can thrive in just about any type of soil. When planted about 6 inches apart, they'll supply a living fence around the garden or even between beds and can act as garden stakes for climbing vines such as cucumbers and tomatoes. Sunflowers are often grown for distracting pests, such as aphids. They're also attractive to bees and other pollen-collecting insects and hummingbirds. Sunflowers are noted as being allelopathic, which means they emit a chemical that prevents other plants from propagating nearby. Amazingly, sunflowers can sprout up to 6 feet high in a matter of 3 months, and seeds are usually harvestable around the same time, possibly extending on to 4 months. I'm Kathy Isom for AgNet West.
Good day, everybody. Albert J. Hernandez, the Untamed Chef for AgNet West. Welcome to the California Kitchen, where you can learn how to cook from an award-winning chef in under 3 minutes or less. I'm your host with the most. Let's get untamed. So it's starting to get a little bit warm now, especially here in the wonderful state of California. So the first thing that comes to mind for me is ice creams and sorbets. And what better thing to cook or to create with right now other than a strawberry? The strawberries are in peak of their season. I would say that they're going to just get a little bit better in a couple of weeks, but they're still pretty darn good if you go with them right now. Now, these are very easy recipes, and sometimes they require a little bit of equipment. And if you guys don't have it, there are other ways of creating these recipes. Even if they're more of old-fashioned style techniques, they do get the job done. So the very first step for this recipe is to take our strawberries. Now I'm going to take 1 quart of strawberries, and I'm going to remove all of the stems. You could do this with a paring knife, or if you have one of those little strawberry or tomato core things, you can use that as well. I've never purchased one. I've always thought it was just an irrelevant tool for me to have personally as a chef, but I'm definitely not knocking it. It's not a bad thing at all. Now, what I'm going to do is take the 1 quart of strawberries, and I'm going to add to that 1 cup of sugar, and I'm going to let that sugar really seep into those strawberries. Now, this is a very important step because I really want to pull out the moisture of our strawberries, and the sugar helps with that. It doesn't do a whole lot with it, but it does help with that process. And I'm going to add 1 cup of water to this, and I'm going to let this sit in my refrigerator. I'm going to let it sit for about an hour. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to put this over a double boiler, Bain-Marie. So remember, a small pot of water, bowl over the top. We are cooking only with the steam. We are not cooking directly in the pot. This is very important because if we don't do this step right here, we're going to end up burning the heck out of our strawberries and making strawberry caramel. We don't want that at all. And very simply, we're going to cook this until the strawberries get really, really soft. I'm going to pour those into a bowl, and I'm going to blend those. I want this to be a puree. This is super important, this step right here, because after this, I'm going to let that puree come down to room temperature, and then I'm going to put it back in the refrigerator for 2 more hours. And lastly, what I'm going to do is put this into an ice cream machine. If you don't have an ice cream machine, you can always do the dry ice method of making ice cream. You can always use the liquid nitrogen method of making ice cream. But remember this. If you don't have any of that stuff at all, take that puree, give it a good whip, very important, whip it for about 2 minutes, and then put it in a bowl, cover it, and put it in the freezer, and I promise it'll still come out. It won't be as great as with the ice cream machine or the other methods, but you'll still have a beautiful sorbet. For this and many more of my recipes, or if you want to contact me directly, go to my website, www.hhtheuntamedchef.com. And as always, this is Albert J. Hernandez, but you all know me as the Untamed Chef from AgNet West.
This is Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. I'm Taylor Hillman.
Specialty crop news brought to you today by the Almond Board of California. You can find them online at almonds.com/growers. The National Agricultural Statistics Service released their new subjective forecast report for California almonds, and the numbers are right where the industry expected, with an increase over last year. The report also showed that unsold inventory is much less than 2018, and Almond Board of California President and CEO Richard Waycott said that the market's setting up nicely for a big 2019 crop, even with trade issues in two major markets.
We're talking with the Almond Board of California's President and CEO, Richard Waycott. Richard, the subjective forecast came out this week. This is the first one. You know, we always wait for the objective one, but the subjective forecast was good news overall, right?
Yeah, we saw an increase up to about 2.5 billion pounds is what they're projecting. That would be up about 250 million pounds over the 2018 crop. We had a pretty serious frost up and down the valley. I should recall last year that drove our yields down, but this year we're seeing yields rebound, and obviously we have more acreage in the ground as well.
We were kind of expecting as an industry like 2.5, 2.6, so we're kind of right there where this is, right?
Yeah, I think we are, and I think as the crop matures here, and NAS actually, the National Agriculture Statistics Service that produces these reports actually gets out in the field, which they do for the objective, and actually, you know, in a statistical way, go about the evaluating the upcoming harvest. I think we'll see, you know, this number get more refined. Whether it might go up a little bit more, we'll have to see.
Yeah, I think we talked about this last year. That's the key, is the subjective forecast is a little assumptuous, I guess. There's some assumptions there, but the objective forecast is they're out in the field, they're checking it. It's a little bit more, seems to be a little bit more accurate. Well, you know, it could possibly go up here. And so this is a conservative estimate that is okay.
Well, I guess I can't call it conservative because I have nothing to necessarily compare it against, but I'd say that, you know, this is done with phone call interviews with growers. The subjective is, the objective, as you said, is actually in the field and stripping limbs of trees and actually doing all the weight counts and the sizing and all that right up and down the state by age of orchards, by variety. So it's a much more detailed, obviously, process to come up with the objective. And it's also closer to harvest, which would take into account sort of how the crops have matured in May and June.
Also, the acreage report was in there. No surprises. How'd the acreage support look?
Yeah, so we're up about 80,000 acres in terms of bearing acres, and that's really in line with what we have been expecting. If you recall, we have about 300,000 acres that's non-bearing, that's in the ground, that's obviously coming on part of that every year into bearing, and so it sort of, you know, it follows. It's logical that we would have increased by about that much.
The other report that came out last week was the positions report. It showed that April compared to last April, there was a little bit of an increase. As you mentioned to me before we started recording, we're down a little bit year to year in shipments. What's going on that market? I mean, it doesn't seem to be too big of an issue, and that's good because of all the tariffs and all that kind of stuff going on.
Yeah, as we're getting near the end of the crop year, and we've had tariffs, the beginning of the tariff wars sort of started about this time last year. What we've seen play out, and I might also add that basically the available inventory this year has been about the same as it was in 2017-18. So we've seen, we didn't have an increase in supply, basically. In fact, we had a little bit of a lower supply this year. So, but with that, we've seen, you know, markets grow or diminish depending on their situation. The two markets that are most affected by the tariffs are obviously China and Turkey, and they're both down over 30% this year, year to date. But certain other markets are up, and one factor also affecting China quite significantly is the export of Australian almonds to China. Australia signed a free trade agreement with China a number of years ago, and their tariff went down to zero as of Jan 1st this year. So they're able to ship into China with no tariff whatsoever. We're at 50% at the moment. So that's sort of skewed trade flows with more Australian product going into China than has traditionally gone there, and then less Australian product necessarily going to some of the other markets that we're shipping a bit more to. So net-net, we're down 1.5% year over year in terms of the year-to-date numbers, and then as you mentioned, we squeaked out a 0.33% increase in the month of April this year versus last year. So that was good.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, with everything going on with trade, that's always a positive sign. So yeah, that's the caveat to Australia having that. And I know I've talked with the Almond Board when that happened. They're shipping more into China, but you know, they're limited on acreage. And so we've capitalized on some of the other markets a little bit, and it's kind of making up for it.
Yeah, their major export market traditionally has been India. When we look at our numbers this year, we're up about 8% in shipments to India year to date. So I think some of that's due to, you know, the Australians being pulled away a bit to China. The other factor is that we're ending up at the moment, the forecast is that the amount of inventory that's left to sell this year versus last year is about 15% less. So we have, again, less inventory going into the last 3 months of our marketing year. And that would dictate that we'll probably end up with a very small, relatively speaking, carry-in, which would be the inventory that's still there when we start up the new crop year August 1st. So there'd be quite a tight supply going into, you know, as we change crop years here before we really get into having ample supplies coming out of the 19 crop. And so that should put a bit of pressure on markets. However, you know, as we're predicting, we'll have about 250 million more pounds coming out of the 19 crop than we had this year, which will increase that supply.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question is, I think that the fear there kind of was, hey, we're going to end up having a bigger surplus going into this season, but that's not the case. So this is kind of setting up nicely. It may you know, move prices around a little bit as we go forward, but it's setting up nicely for the industry.
Yeah, and it's, you know, you never like to have a frost or never. We always want to, you know, have our growers produce everything they can. But given the market situations of the last 12 months, it was a bit fortuitous that we didn't have a huge increase in supply at the same time these tariffs were going in.
Very good, sir. I appreciate it.
Yeah, great to talk to you.
This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. We'll have more of the day's agriculture news in just a moment. And remember, you can always get the latest agriculture news from around the state and the nation at our website, agnetwest.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Farm City News Day by AgNet West. I'm Taylor Hillman.
What might the new marketing year's wheat production forecast, expected to be record-setting, mean for the U.S. wheat export opportunities and grower prices? Rod Bain has the answer.
Global record wheat production is in the forecast for the 2019-2020 marketing year.
And on top of that, all the major exporters in the world, we have expectations of increases in production year over year,
leading to a forecast of over 777 million tons of wheat to be produced worldwide, according to USDA World Agricultural Outlook Board Chair Seth Meyer. And it is contributing to the challenge of U.S. wheat producers exporting their crops to global markets.
And actually an expectation that exports will fall 25 million bushels to 900 million bushels of exports for 1920.
And what that means for the first U.S. wheat balance sheet for the new marketing season is flat ending stocks year over year.
And with all those global supplies of wheat around, in order to get to that export volume, we're going to have to sell at a cheaper price. So that's part of what's driving that 50-cent lower price to $4.70 for the 1920 crop.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
May is National Mental Health Month, and a new survey commissioned by the American Farm Bureau Federation reveals how farmers and ranchers are holding up against a wide range of challenges. Chad Smith has the report.
With challenges in the farm economy weighing heavily on farmers and ranchers, the American Farm Bureau Federation commissioned a nationwide poll to learn more about the state of mental health and wellness in rural America. Ray Atkinson, AFBF Director of Strategic Communications, talks about some of the top takeaways from the survey.
4 in 5 farmers and farm workers said financial issues, fear of losing the farm or business problems impact the mental health of farmers. This is very concerning because of the depressed state of the farm economy. We know it's having an impact. But one of the positive things we learned was that an overwhelming percentage of rural adults, 91%, said mental health is important to them and or their family.
82% of farmers and farm workers also said mental health was important to them, which Atkinson says is encouraging. A majority of rural adults say there is at least a fair amount of stigma associated with mental health.
Those numbers were lower for stigma around seeking treatment or help for a mental health condition. And 3 in 4 rural adults said it's important to reduce stigma about mental health in the agriculture community. We know there's a great deal of stigma associated with mental health, particularly in rural areas, so it's good to hear that rural Americans want to break this cycle of stigma.
Atkinson says AFBF is working with state farm bureaus to compile information on available education and support programs in each state.
We know from our work on the rural opioid issue that there are a huge amount of resources already there. In fact, sometimes the amount of information is just overwhelming. So in many cases, it's just a matter of knowing where the resources are, which ones are the most reputable and helpful, and then making those resources easy to access.
Chad Smith, Washington.
Now recapping today's top stories.
When developing groundwater sustainability plans, a multitude of different factors must be considered. Executive Director of the Eastern Thule GSA, Bryce McAteer, talked about the importance of water markets and GSPs.
You know, water markets are the most efficient way to manage and share a scarce resource and a resource that likely is going to become a lot scarcer over time. But if you also have a comprehensive water market system or a comprehensive sharing system, you can increase the localized benefits of that market. And so if you can incorporate recharge projects and recharge credits, if you can have good monitoring, there's a lot of different systematic issues that have to be considered, and a lot of different components to make that market function. But in my opinion, markets are a valuable asset for any GSA. It's important for growers to know how much groundwater do they have so they can plan for the future on what do they want to grow, how might they want to change their cropping patterns or their business patterns, and it's important to provide that sort of security for the long run.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can follow AgNet West on Twitter and Facebook with @AgNetWest. Follow Brian German with @BrianAgNetWest, Danielle Leal with @DLealAgNetWest, and Taylor Hillman with @TheManOfTheHill. This has been Farm City Newsday by AgNet West.